The following program contains scenes and language of a frank and explicit nature. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hello, and welcome to Film Jitsu, the podcast that wields films like deadly weapons. We are your hosts. I am Jay.
And I am Mike.
On this episode of Film Jitsu, Mike had to sit through the insanity that is 2014's As the Gods Will, a totally bonkers Takashi Miike film based on a Japanese manga of the same name. Will Mike see Miike's eccentricity as irreverent, madcap horror worth watching? Or is it another hunted high schooler's flick that's simply too off the wall for anyone in their right mind to recommend? Only the Daruma song knows for sure, so we'll have to wait until either Mike's head explodes or he solves the problem in time to find out. And once all that happens, we'll move on to our bottom five dolls, a discussion revolving around unblinking faces, disfigured limbs, and the discomfort they offer. After that, we'll play a first round of dueling double bills for 2026 before Mike unveils what nesting doll of horror awaits me for our next episode. But before all that, as always, let's roll the trailer for what I'm sure is a completely incomprehensible minute and a half, As the Gods Will.
Should we try to just perform the trailer? Because the whole thing is definitely not in English.
It's not.
It's just going to be incomprehensible noise and then people speaking in a different language.
And screaming and... I think so.
Daruma-sanga!
Koronda!
Gire!
チュッチュッチュッチュッ背中かいいの。やめろ。神様なんかクソくらだ。神様の言う通り。
Mike, I saw this movie with my kids. The genesis of this really was that Diego became obsessed with this on YouTube at a very young and inappropriate age. And he got pretty scared from what he saw. It was the Daruma doll at the beginning of the film that kicks things off. And it plays essentially what is a red light, green light game. And kids' heads are exploding and turning into marbles and et cetera, right? This was not a good thing for a kid to stumble on YouTube to see.
Right. Yeah.
Luckily, his brother sort of talked him through it and everything was okay. However, he never quite got rid of the visual or rid of the idea of this film. And such, we all ended up watching it one time. And oh my God, he's the only one that appreciated anything about it.
Well, at least he was able to stumble across it on YouTube, because we're back to my favorite part of the show. How did Mike watch a movie? Which is, once again, I think the underlying strategy here is you are trying to find more and more complicated ways for me to watch a movie, because I couldn't find this anywhere because of licensing fuckery, right? What was easily accessible. And thankfully you came in with the save and gave it to me with English subtitles, because I think I found it with like Russian subtitles one time and it was bananas. So it took me nearly a week to be able to find a version of this film that I could watch and understand. But understand is maybe an overstatement, because this is a film that is, although extremely simple in what it's showing us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazingly confusing about what the fuck is actually going on.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
For sure.
No setup whatsoever.
No.
None.
No.
It's just some rumination about life being boring by the lead character, and then we're in.
What this movie is, by Japanese auteur Takashi Miike, is about a group of high school students that are just going through one sort of child's death game after another. We have, like That's you right. say, we have a, there's a cat and mouse game. There's red light, green light. We have sort of a ring around the rosy kind of thing.
Yep. Yep.
And these characters just move from one thing to another as the class gets whittled down smaller and smaller with almost no explanation about how or why or what for. And on the one hand, that sounds like I'm being critical of it, and I think that I am, but on the other hand, it's like, well, the movie started, I get what's happening, even if I don't know why, and so I'm just kind of along for the ride.
Sure.
And it is quite a ride. It really is. It's such an interesting addition to Takashi Miike's filmography, right? Because he has done so many things. He's such a prolific director. He's done over 100 titles in almost every genre that you can think of. Mm-hmm. He's interested in extreme violence and transgression in films like Ichi the Killer and Audition, which is how I know him best.
Mm-hmm.
But he's done comedies. He's kind of obsessed with absurdism,
yes,
which is
sure.
could not be more evident than in As the Gods Will.
Mm-hmm.
But even with all that fluidity in his filmmaking, he's often seen as an auteur. And I think that although you can't pin him down with one idea or one style, I would say that he's a director that's sort of fascinated with compelling us to watch what he puts on screen, no matter what it is. You can't look away from this guy's films, whether they're violent or scary or just bananas like this movie is. You have to watch what he puts out for you. And it's this kind of relentless productivity and genre experimentation that mm-hmm. makes him an interesting guy. And
yeah.
so I couldn't dismiss this movie as much as it seems kind of dismissible.
It does. It gives you the overall impression that this is just nonsense. Mm-hmm. Although I did wonder if some of this was almost quite literally lost in translation. That
yeah.
we are not familiar with that culture. Perhaps
for sure.
enough to really appreciate the nuance and the subtlety that is in there.
Absolutely.
There was definitely stuff that I did not know, like those dolls that they play the Ring Around the Rosie game with.
Yep.
Those are clearly characters that Japanese folks are understanding of and know who they are. So they'll be able to select who is who. But mm-hmm. to you and I watching the thing, this is completely alien. We have no idea what we're looking at.
For sure.
And it yep. it does really make it challenging.
I think you're definitely right. I felt that too. I knew there were cultural touchstones here that were beyond
you.
Me.
Yeah. yeah.
Whether or not that decreased or increased or was maybe neutral on my appreciation of the film, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
But I was so fascinated with the special effects in this movie because
yeah,
my immediate reaction was like, these are trash and poorly done and it looks terrible. And then in the next moment, I was like, is this actually pretty darn good? And it was
yeah.
either really well-crafted special effects for the scale of the film that was made, or they mm-hmm. are really bad special effects for the scale of the film that was made. And I don't know which one it was.
I think they were really good overall, yeah. personally. I think that the production design was exquisite in a lot of ways. The mm-hmm. Daruma doll with its bloodshot eyes and its kind of crooked grin and all of that. There was so much character in that
right.
CG that I felt as though, wow, like that is some serious artwork. It's the same with the money cat that chases after kids that are dressed as mice. And it was all the way down the line. But I think where it really stood out for me, the special effects, was in the surfboarding polar bear sequence.
Yes, the lion game, right?
The lion game, which for me was actually the high point of the film.
Mm.
I got sort of emotionally invested a little bit in that part of it.
So this is the sequence where a giant polar bear
he snowboards in
pits the students against each other, saying one of them is a liar and they have to identify who it is, and they kind of have to choose one of among them to who is the liar, who's
or
the
they'll
traitor,
all die.
Or they're all die. And when they point somebody out, that person is killed. And
correct.
You're right. Up until I think maybe the final game, I was pretty with this movie. I thought the Daruma doll was interesting. The cat and mouse bit, as silly as it was, where we have students donning mice costumes that where did those come from? I don't know.
Right.
All of it was pretty compelling. When we got to the end with the Russian nesting dolls and the kick the can game, I was sort of out at that point. I wasn't with it anymore.
I went back in, but I was on a second viewing. So that might have been why, because I lost all energy in my first viewing right around the Ring Around the Rosie sequence. So you made it further than I did in your first viewing.
Did you check out then perhaps when a young woman who lost the game was pulled in half by these dolls? Because, wow.
They do, but they don't show it, right?
They don't.
I think it's such a judicious cut sequence where they're showing one foot get pulled, and they're using audio.
Uh-huh.
But then they show that over the top shot of the girl, and the blood is sort of pooling out of focus behind her, which is just horrifying.
It is. It's so shocking and it's so provoking. And even though this is kind of the brilliance of Miike, sometimes he wants to rub your nose in it. And other times he wants you to rub your own nose in it. And I think that's one of those sequences where you feel you have everything you need to know about what's going on, and your brain just kind of fills in the rest.
Sure.
And it's so effective because he oscillates kind of back and forth between those two approaches. And so sometimes you're like, this is cartoonish and silly and dumb. But then he does something that is just like startlingly violent, and it pulls you right back into the reality of the film, which is a crazy thing to say because we're talking about giant cats and stuff and a snowboarding polar bear for some reason.
And no characters, really. I mean, there's not a lot of explanation as to who anybody was. Mm-mm. It didn't seem to matter other than the fact that our lead character had an antagonist who just seemed as though he was an absolute brute. Mm-hmm. Who just beat up on everybody and thought that it was God's will, essentially, that he was able to win all the time. And then there was a girl that he was his crush, really. That's how Diego described it, his crush. It was really just about the games.
Mm-hmm.
The weird thing was, and I didn't remember this when I first watched it because I don't think I made it far enough in, but there is some context presented for what's happening. But it makes even less sense than the games.
Mm-hmm.
These giant cubes that show up all throughout the globe.
Right.
That sort of, it's like Independence Day.
It reminded me of Arrival.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think what we're supposed to take is this is happening inside these cubes, maybe all around the world.
It sounds like to me it was every high school in the world.
Right.
And then the winners of the Daruma games would end up in the gymnasiums where they would get beaten by the money cat.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they get gassed, they end up in the cubes.
Right.
And then the cubes are where the rest of the games play out.
And there was some sort of sequence that I think was trying to say this had something to do with like the world has gone sour. It's violent and it's stupid. And this is almost some sort of like intergalactic thinning of the herd or something.
I don't know.
It was tough to make sense of what was being presented.
The messaging here was
there.
Very convoluted because there was a homeless guy that ended up being perhaps God by the end of the film. And then there was a guy that was like a mama's boy sitting staring at a computer in hente for a while. And then he comes out of his room and says, I'm going to go save the world. And then he just disappears and there's no explanation. I think it's supposed to set up a second film. There is a second manga.
Yes. And it does seem very much to me like this film is setting up a second part of a story that
feels that way.
That obviously we're not familiar with because we haven't read those books and they never went ahead and made those movies. Whether it was Miike's intention to make a second film or not, I don't know. It definitely doesn't help you wrap your head around what's going on yeah, this might be the only movie, but maybe there's another movie and something about cubes and aliens and everybody's dead, but not dead. And that, who the fuck is that guy? Like, what happened to that guy's head? And so here we go. I will tell you though, the film is just punctuated with so many candidates for our end of the year death scene that I have a list like a mile long going already, and they're all from this movie.
So true.
It's going to be hard for 2026 to top this film when it comes to death scenes. And I don't want to ruin it yet, but wow.
It's funny because I thought the same thing when you gave me The Postman and they had this rigorous and lengthy sex scene in it. I'm like, right out of the gate, Mike's giving me something for the jitsus next year. We'll see how we keep going here. But it's funny. Mike is such an interesting auteur. He's so unpredictable. Mm-hmm. But this movie truly felt to me like it was the sum of all of his experience thrown into one flick without any tonal balance whatsoever. It was just all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the idea really was to torture you.
Yeah.
But then I felt as though there was going to be, and it sounds like there was, a level of appreciation for the craft of the film.
Takashi Miike's resume makes him impossible to dismiss. You can't just watch this film and say, well, this is garbage, or dismiss it out of hand before you've even seen it, because this guy has earned the respect of watching his films, right? Like, if Takashi Miike has made a movie, then I'm gonna watch that movie and take it seriously from start to finish. And sometimes you get Ichi the Killer, and sometimes you get As the Gods Will. And so I think that it's hard to know how to calibrate your brain and be like, is this just as brilliant as everything else he does and I am not following it and I don't get it? Or is he fucking with me? Right? Like,
yeah,
is he
like, I'm gonna,
right? I kind of was like, is this guy fucking with me? Is he like, everybody knows that when he makes a movie, it's sort of appointment viewing. And so he's like, I'm Takashi Miike. I made a movie. Everybody has to watch it. So this is what I'm going to make. Ha ha on you. My sense is that's probably reductive. And whatever the cultural impact is of these manga, whatever the cultural influences are that are in this movie that clearly are over our head, I would love to have this conversation with somebody who knows this culture well and who understands maybe the source material at all. But for me, it was like, is this guy pranking me? I'm just not sure.
That's how it felt. I'm like, this can't be the same guy that made Audition. I'm not even that big of a fan of Audition, but the level of sophisticated storytelling there can't be denied.
For sure,
It looks and feels like a serious, dramatic film that exists in a real world.
Mm-hmm.
This is the complete opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I wanted to kind of see where you wound up with it.
Yeah, right.
Was this as difficult for you as it was for me? Because it was a tough, tough watch for me.
It was, but all kidding aside, right? I joked at the beginning about how hard it was for me to watch this movie. And so I watched it in these little like bites here and there. I think it was probably over a week and a half that you and I were trying to figure out how I was going to be able to watch this thing. And I was like, tonight's the night. And then something happened. And so I watched this in all of these little digestible bits. But at no point was I like, this is bullshit. I don't need to finish this. Like, I was never tempted to dismiss the movie or just kind of give up on it because I felt like I get it. But as I went along, I was like, I know there's something going on here that I should be taking in. I don't know if when I get to the end, I'll be able to tell you what that is. But I'm glad that I watched the movie. And I am curious. Squid Game was such an enormous success.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it's fair to draw the comparison? I think it has to be at least fair. I don't know if it's useful.
Yeah.
But do you think that people that enjoyed Squid Game should watch this?
Not at all.
No.
No.
No. Okay.
No.
Yeah.
Not at all. I mean, I'm a huge Squid Game fan, and it has a very sophisticated underlying message about economic inequality.
Right.
And the sort of desperation that lives because of money, just it our relationship with money as a people, as a society, right? Regardless of whether it's Korean or American, wherever. This movie didn't offer almost anything other than hokum for its explanation about the mundanities of life and how he starts to appreciate how boring his life was, the lead character.
Right.
And that is just not Squid Game. Squid Game has a lot on its mind.
Sure.
Yes. I would say that the setup of Squid Game with the children's games and the way that it whittles down the numbers, so to speak, is very similar to what happens in As the Gods Will. But As the Gods Will is, as you said, an absurdist venture. And it doesn't have the interest in saying anything substantial in an honest way that Squid Game does.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1
Well, Mike, thank you so much for sticking it out with As the Gods Will. I know that that was a little bit of a tough watch, what with the difficulty of finding the film, first of all, and then understanding it, which at one point you said to me, I'm now able to watch it, but I can't watch it with subtitles, but I'm not sure it matters. And I was like thinking to myself, I don't think it matters either, but all right.
I stand by it. And when I said that, I was like, I know he's going to think that I'm being a snarky shit right now.
No.
But I genuinely was like, I don't think I need to know what they're saying to know what's going on in this movie because it didn't help
at
me.
All. But what I took away from my first viewing of As the Gods Will, where there were a hell of a lot of dolls in that movie. So to me, I thought, why not do bottom five dolls? Now, when I chose this, of course, the challenge was we had previously done bottom five puppets. There could be a little bit of overlap. And also, it's really easy to go an obvious route and neither one of us like the obvious route. So with all that said, what was your approach?
When you first gave it to me, I was like, oh, that's a breeze. And then once I started digging in, it's like, this is actually a lot more sort of a narrow category than I realized, especially if you don't want to just tread over the same things again and again.
Right.
I think it's likely that these lists are going to lean heavily on evil dolls. Some people have a rare fear of dolls. It's called, I looked it up, it's called pediophobia, and it's an anxiety disorder. It's actually a subset of automatonophobia, which is the fear of inanimate objects appearing human-like. My daughter, for example, isn't a real big fan of dolls. We go to a haunted house every year, and they have a scary doll room that kind of short-circuits her brain pretty good. But me... Dolls never scared me, mostly because I've always felt like I could just stomp the shit out of them. Even as a kid, I felt like I could just punt Chucky across the driveway, stuff him in a trash can, put the lid on top, put a brick on it, and that's the end of the movie. So evil dolls aren't really a big thing for me. It's not a category of films I'm particularly interested in. But with that said, my number five is an evil doll. And I think it's kind of my antidote against a pick that felt way too obvious. We've had a lot of occasions to mention the possessed clown in Poltergeist.
Yeah, that's too many, so true.
I think. We both like this. It really resonates with us. We bring it up a lot. And so I wanted to come up with something a little more outside the box than that. And I did, outside of the Jack-in-the-Box, actually. My number five is the giant evil Jack-in-the-Box with a mouthful of razor-sharp teeth from the 2005 Christmas horror film Krampus. This is a movie about a Christmas that has gone horribly wrong, including the toys all coming to life and trying to kill everyone. Gingerbread men with machine guns and the flesh-eating Dare Clown, a human-sized Jack-in-the-Box who eats three members of this family before the movie is over. Like, three of our principal cast get killed by this human Jack-in-the-Box. He's just this kind of nasty son of a bitch. It's actually really pretty good practical effects in a film that has some solid creature design. So, somewhat in homage to the Poltergeist clown, my number five is Der Clown from Krampus.
I love it. That's a great choice.
Does it count as a doll? I was worried it might not.
I think it's Film Jitsu. Who the fuck cares, right? Okay, like, come on. For instance, my number five is a little bit of the stretch of the concept as well, and that is the dad doll, or just the whole button-eyed concept from 2002's Coraline.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Directed by Henry Selick and adapted from Neil Gaiman's novel. Coraline is one of those films that smuggled existential horror into a family-friendly box, and they never look back. The dad doll, specifically, it's mute, smiling, incomplete. Mm. It's awful. Yep. But the real nightmare is that button-eyed concept itself.
Yeah.
Buttons erase identity. They replace perception with obedience. They turn people into decor. That's not a jump scare. That's a evil philosophy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The stop motion craftsmanship of this film is immaculate. And that only makes it all worse. And Bruno Del Bono's cinematography gives the other world a lacquered funhouse sheen that feels poisonous.
Mm.
This is a doll not meant to attack you, but to keep you.
Mm.
Combined with the wider button eye motif, the film suggests a fate worse than death, existing forever as a smiling, decorative lie. I don't know about you, but that sounds like about half the population of the United States right now.
It's such a good example of why you're smarter than I am, because I wrestled with Coraline and didn't land on the father, although I so obviously should.
Oh, man.
That sort of jangly,
yes,
almost zombified absence where he's kind of playing this sort of marionette where there's so much sadness in the physicality of that character. Mm-hmm. That you're right. I don't know why. I don't know, because you're smarter than me. That's why you thought of it and I didn't. That's why. That's why. It's
just
such
give
a
me your
pick.
Number four.
It's
stop
such
with
a good
this
pick.
Flattery.
No, it's true. My number four feels more like an obligation than a pick that I'm excited about. But
oh,
yeah, I am gonna go with Annabelle from the Conjuring universe for looking hilariously, cartoonishly, and idiotically evil. It's here almost because it feels like it has to be. It's like, that's my criticism. It is, if you're doing a bottom five dolls list, Annabelle has to be on here. And I don't mean that in a complimentary way.
Fair.
Nobody makes this doll.
This
no
so
toy
true.
Company makes a doll that looks that fucking terrifying out of the box. It's actually laughable. The second I laid eyes on that thing, I literally laughed out loud and immediately checked out of the movie. It's
fair.
So over the top. It's like something from a Naked Gun movie. It's that just like
it's
cartoonishly
so
stupid.
Yeah.
And so because evil dolls are dumb, and this might be the pinnacle of evil dolls are dumb, it's my number four.
That's a great pick. I love the way you describe it, and that's why it belongs on the list.
Yeah.
And as you often say with our list, sometimes we need to include a specific, obvious choice.
Yeah.
Or else we lose all credibility as a podcast.
I would have put Annabelle here for being evil and for being whatever and for being all the things that she's supposed to be. But I'm really kind of taking more of your approach. It's like, she sucks. And
she
that's
sucks.
What it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Terrible character design. Mm-hmm. Much like the Pennywise of the newer It movies.
Yeah.
Who's going to go anywhere near that fucking clown? Right.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. My number four is perhaps one that's going to be on your list. It may even be high up on your list. Sid's mutant baby doll from Toy Story.
Mm.
Directed by John Lasseter, Pixar's original Toy Story gave us something that no one was prepared for. DIY Cronenberg dolls made out of Fisher-Price trauma.
Cronenberg dolls? Good Lord.
Long before Pixar perfected warmth and reassurance, it accidentally wandered into pure body horror, and it never quite returned. Sid's mutant toys, especially the baby doll head grafted onto an Erector-set spider body, aren't villains, they're survivors, which somehow makes them worse. They don't attack, they don't threaten, they exist. Crawling out of the shadows of Sid's room like proof that innocence can be dismantled and reassembled into something unrecognizable. Designed as a visual gag, they linger like a fucking curse. What makes the baby doll so disturbing is that it's never framed as evil. It's just wrong. A nurturing object repurposed into an industrial nightmare fuel. Pixar never pushed imagery this grotesque again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to see why. Once you've shown a baby doll rebuilt as a metal arachnid silently skittering across the floor, there's really nowhere left to go. This is accidental horror at its purest, and it's one of the most indelible, quietly traumatizing images in animated film history. Number four, Sid's mutant baby doll from Toy Story.
No one's ever attempted a double bypass brain transplant before. Now for the tricky part. Pliers!
I don't believe that man's ever been to medical school.
My number three is a pick that might veer a little bit closer to action figure than a doll. But again, it's a pretty narrow category, and so I think some flexibility is required. There's no way this is on your list.
I think it is.
I don't think it is at all, because I'm going with the Turbo Man doll from the Arnold Schwarzenegger holiday film Jingle All the Way.
No, it's not. Wow.
No, see, I knew, yeah. For some reason, this low-rent Power Ranger is the hottest toy of the Christmas season. It's got grown adults trampling each other at toy stores. It sets off a citywide showdown between all-American dad Arnold Schwarzenegger and stand-up comedian Sinbad, of all people, for some reason. Turbo Man's powers appear to be owns a jetpack and shoots a disc thingy. That's it. That's
okay.
It. He fights a dude named Dementor, who has a giant brain in a fishbowl. Everything about Turbo Man is lame and second rate. It's like a knockoff dollar store G.I. Joe named like G.I. Jorp that your grandmother might buy because she's on a fixed income and thinks that maybe the kid won't notice, but you definitely notice that you didn't get a G.I. Joe and you got a G.I. Jorp instead. I noticed the difference. Everybody should have noticed the difference. Turbo Man fucking sucks, and they made a whole movie about it. So that's it for me. Number three, Turbo Man.
I just was thinking about this great line from Trading Places where Eddie Murphy's talking about
Christmas is around the corner, and I ain't gonna have no money to buy my son the G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu grip.
Oh, man, that's good. That's good. What a great pick. Wow. Your film knowledge goes deep sometimes, my friend. Wow. Mine was a much more obvious action figure, but they count as dolls, man.
I think so.
And this was kind of a weird mix of meta usage when it came to like Masters of the Universe versus G.I. Joe. Mm-hmm. And that is in 1998, Small Soldiers.
Mm.
Directed by Joe Dante, written by Adam Rifkin, and produced by none other than fucking Steven Spielberg. Small Soldiers is a toy movie that becomes a satire about militarism, corporate negligence, and the dangers of giving action figures real-world doctrine. The commando elite aren't haunted. They're programmed. Loaded with military AI and voiced by actors like Tommy Lee Jones, they're dolls with ideology. They don't just want to win. They want to eradicate. And crucially, they're voiced by veterans of the cast of The Dirty Dozen. Dante leans hard into the irony, but the imagery, Barbie limbs repurposed as shrapnel, suburban homes turned into war zones, lands a lot harder than expected. These dolls don't represent childhood trauma. They fucking manufacture it. There's a chilling scene where they interrogate a Gorgonite figure. That's the Masters of the Universe good guys. Mm-hmm. Treating a toy like an enemy combatant. That's where the film crosses from mischief into something darker. The horror isn't that they're alive. It's that they believe they're right.
That lands a little bit differently today, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Doesn't it though?
Yep.
Fuck, man. Nothing is fun anymore.
Nope. But that's Steven Spielberg. He's always one step ahead of us, isn't he?
And Joe Dante.
That's an excellent pick. I don't know that I'm in a place psychologically to grapple with how dead ass that is. So I think I might just need to move on.
I think we better just
my
go
number
to the next
two.
One.
And it's good actually that you mentioned the Barbie dolls, because my number two, the Barbie movie is full of dolls. And I loved this movie. I don't know that you and I ever talked much about the Barbie movie.
We haven't, actually. No.
I saw it in theaters, I think, three, maybe even four times.
Wow.
I listened to the soundtrack all summer long. I loved the movie. One of its charms is that they packed it full of references to all the weird random versions of the Barbie doll, the ones that like didn't land or didn't sell and all that sort of thing. But my pick here is Ken, as played by Ryan Gosling. Now, I thought Gosling was great in the role. He understood the assignment completely, with him kind of poking fun at his own persona. And I'm Just Ken was a hilarious song that I still sing at top volume to annoy my kids. So why then is Ken on my list at number two? It's a bit of a real world situation. Because as much as I like the performance, it's bullshit that the women who anchored this mega hit about female empowerment and autonomy, namely Margot Robbie and director Greta Gerwig, didn't receive any Oscar nominations, while Gosling, the dude involved, was recognized by the Academy.
Oh, for sure.
It was like the real world patriarchy proving the movie's entire fucking point. And to his credit, Gosling knew it too. After the nominations came out, he was quoted as saying, "There is no Barbie movie without Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie, the two people most responsible for this history-making, globally celebrated film."
Hmm.
He was absolutely right about that, because the real-world fuckery of the male lead getting nominated over the female lead whose name is in the goddamn title card, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Makes Ken my number two.
That's such a quality pick for the reason that you chose it. I'm not a huge fan of that movie.
Oh,
but I love what it represents. And I will fight for that all day long and twice on Sunday.
I think it's fascinating because in the Barbenheimer of it all, right? The
way you just described that movie. Another movie that I don't love, by the way.
But you just described Barbie in the same terms I would have described Oppenheimer, which is it's not a movie I particularly enjoyed, but I'm glad that it exists.
Me too.
But man, I went all in head over heels for Barbie.
You guys are clearly not doing patriarchy very well.
No, we're
doing it well. Yeah, we just hide it better now.
Oh.
My number two is May's doll Susie from the 2002 film May.
I haven't seen it.
Oh God, you need to watch this movie. It's written and directed by Lucky McKee. May gives us perhaps the most emotionally upsetting doll on this list. Not because it kills, but because it listens.
Oh.
The doll, gifted by May's unhinged mother, has that glassy, judgmental stare that suggests it's absorbing everything. It's not haunted. It's worse. It's present. Angela Bettis' performance is the secret weapon here, turning the doll into an emotional barometer for loneliness, repression, and rot. By the time May decides to make her own, quote, best friend, the doll stops being a comfort object and becomes a blueprint. The film has become a cult favorite precisely because it understands that the most terrifying thing a doll can do is witness someone unraveling. One of the film's most devastating moments comes when May returns home from her first kiss after she bites Adam, played by Jeremy Sisto, panicked and confused, and immediately blames Susie the doll. When reality doesn't match what that doll prepared her for, May doesn't adjust. She escalates.
Oh.
The most chilling doll moment in May, though, isn't visual. It's sonic. During a scene where May leaves an awkward voicemail for Adam, the camera frames Susie in the foreground. There's a pause, just a beat too long, and buried in that silence is a barely audible whisper, "Help me." It's not emphasized. It's not subtitled. It's the first of several subconscious audio drops that leave you wondering whether the doll spoke, whether May imagined it, or whether the film itself is messaging you, the viewer. By the time the film reaches its infamous third act, the doll's fixed stare retroactively becomes terrifying because you realize it didn't comfort her. It normalized the idea of replacing people with parts.
Ooh.
It is just an awesome, awesome, awesome horror movie.
Well, I said at the top, I'm not a big fan of scary dolls, but you kind of gave me the willies in like the first couple of lines there that you were describing. I was like, ugh, I got like the shivers here. I was like, okay, all right.
Ugh, that's why listens. I giggled a little bit. I saw
it
you
just
reacting.
Listened. I was like, oh, it just listens. That's ugh. I'm not.
It
I
is
don't like
rough.
That.
That's exactly. Like that. And what happens is as her emotional well-being collapses, the glass case that the doll lives in, because it can never be opened or played with, this doll just sits behind glass.
What?
The glass cracks.
No.
And you're always hearing that whenever she's starting to lose it. Boy, oh boy, is this a bottom five doll.
Okay. Now I'm there. Yeah, you might have actually convinced me to watch a scary doll movie.
Please
well
do.
Done.
Please do.
Well done. My number one, speaking of scary doll movies, and you kind of highlighted this before again, we talked about the obviousness of Chucky, and he's not going to be on my list, but my number one pick is Tiffany Valentine from Bride of Chucky, voiced by the delightful Jennifer Tilly.
Oh, so delightful.
My problem here is that Tiffany represents a tonal shift in the Child's Play franchise that, in my opinion, it never recovers from.
Oh.
The original Child's Play was dark. The second one was mean and nasty, and the third one was just pretty goofy. Mm. But the introduction of Tiffany tipped the movies into being intentionally campy in a way that I think cuts the legs right out from under the franchise.
Mm.
It's not because she's a female or any stupid incel bullshit like that. In fact, I like Tilly's performance kind of as a standalone, right?
Yeah.
But it's just that the introduction of the character sent the franchise down a path that makes it feel like a violent, horny, married with children episode. And I haven't enjoyed one of them since, which is a bummer and my reason for making it my number one. I just, for me, I was on board with the Child's Play franchise, and then Tiffany takes it in a whole other direction that I was just never on board with. And so that's why it's my number one.
And of course, we disagree entirely. That entire franchise doesn't kick into high gear for me until she shows up. And then I really enjoy those films.
Okay.
She would have made it on my top five dolls probably. Yeah. So, well, my number one felt impossibly obvious.
Mm.
And I can't believe it didn't land on your list. I can only imagine it's because you never saw it, because I am a ridiculously old man and you are not. My number one is the Zuni fetish doll from Trilogy of Terror.
Yeah.
The 1975 TV movie. Directed by Dan Curtis and written by none other than Richard fucking Matheson.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's forever remembered for the final segment. It's three segments, all starring Karen Black. This one, however, has the angriest 6 inches of plastic this side of a, I'm not even going to say, the Zuni doll. It isn't creepy because it's mysterious. It's creepy because it's purely transactional violence. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no tragic backstory, no moral lesson, just a ceremonial object whose sole purpose is to wake up and choose murder. What elevates it is the commitment. Like, the doll never pauses, it never reassesses, it never reflects. In the ending, where Black's character Amelia becomes possessed, and she's baring her teeth in that final freeze frame, turns a TV anthology into something genuinely primally horrifying.
Of course I've seen it. And of course you're right. And this was one of those times where I didn't include it in my list because I just put absolute faith that I was like, Santo's going to do this. I know it. It's I know he's going to do it. Of course he's going to do it. It's like, this is a Santo pick.
Yes.
If there's a bottom five available where we can also talk about Karen Black, that is not my territory. You've earned that.
Thanks, man.
Jason, it's time for us to play our very first round of Dueling Double Bills in 2026.
Woohoo!
This is that part of the show where we have a couple of randomly generated titles, and then you and I have to find a title to pair it with, like a fine wine, like a like a Cool Ranch Doritos and Mountain Dew, to find to find a film that would make the best possible double bill.
Mm-hmm.
I want to take this opportunity, though, before we dive in, to remind our audience that from 2025, we turned this into a bit of a contest, which was a draw. and neither one of us came out on top of this entire foolish exercise last year. And so what that means is that on the website, filmjitsu.net, our listeners can go and vote on what double bill they would like each of us to have to watch. I'll be interested to hear what our listeners' tastes are, because some of them are really good pairings.
Yeah.
Some of them are really shit films. And so are they going to want to do the film jitsu thing and make us watch bad films? Or are they interested in having us talk about some good films? Because you never know what you're going to get in dueling double bills.
And I also want to mention that with every episode that we've been posting on the website, we've been including the poll. So you can just go to any of the past few episodes on the website and you can vote right on the episode's pages. Now, with all that said, Mike, are you ready?
I am.
Are you ready for
our
first
one
for 2026? I don't know that I am. Well, let's see what we've got here. It's thinking, holy shit. Yes, of course. Our first film is Houseu.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, man. I think there's a clock in this movie that eats people. Like, this is great. There's definitely a bed that eats someone in it.
Oh, boy.
All right. And our second film is going to be, oh, man, we couldn't get out of this without having to mention this film. It's Dolls from Reanimator's director, Stuart Gordon. Yes. Technically speaking, produced by none other than Charles Band, or He Who Should Not Be Named.
Oh, what do we do? Isn't he in the Hall of Lame?
No.
He produced it.
Yes. So we don't need to talk about him. We could talk about Stuart Gordon, because we don't get to discuss Stuart Gordon very much. And he does have a pretty extensive horror career that we could talk about. And he's made some pretty shitty movies too. I'm surprised we haven't actually had some of that on the show.
Yeah.
Things like Robot Jocks. I mean, like, good God. Even that Lovecraft one that he did, Dagon, not a particularly good flick. He was so hit or miss. And the thing that I always love about Stuart Gordon and Yuzna and stuff is that those guys had influence on that whole Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
They did.
It's just absolutely wild that they had that crossover. So yeah, we're looking at Houseu, which I see it does relate to everything that we were talking about tonight, especially with As the Gods Will. It's this just absolute insane Japanese horror art film. It's very experimental. It's very insane. And then Dolls, which is a more conventional toy-centric kind of fairy tale punishment sort of thing. It's got its humor and such, but I don't know where I'm going to go with this. I remember from Houseu that the director's child had a lot of input in how that film was constructed. So that'll be an interesting thing. My immediate thought, man, is going to be super dumb.
Great.
I suck at this game. I can't believe I came up with this game because I'm so bad at it. All right.
Jay, I'm really excited to talk about Houseu because, as luck would have it, this past summer, I took a road trip down to my favorite place on earth, the Mahoning Drive-In Theater, where they did a screening of Houseu. I have notes, actually, that I took down because I thought this might make a great future episode, right? There's a lot going on in Houseu. It's basically Jaws, but the house is the shark. That's what it is. And what is really interesting is that Obayashi, the director, was sort of processing this generational trauma about the atomic bomb this movie. Yeah. And the line that I walked away from with this is, just as war needs a steady stream of young lives, so does Auntie. This is the line from the movie, right? Whoa, okay.
Yeah.
But with all of that seriousness, what we have here is just this haunted house movie that is wall-to-wall cartoonish bonanza.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
house.
Sito, I saved you.
I see in your eyes where tomorrow.
And so for me, the pairing that I want to put forth, I absolutely can see a line around the corner for this double bill. Knowing what I know about horror fans, the way they feel about this movie, and the way they feel about Sam Raimi's Evil Dead 2.
Yeah, yep. That's right. The same kind of madcap slapstick.
Absolutely.
His is more Three Stooges.
Yep.
And Obayashi's is more art house cinema, but you don't want the same thing in your pairing.
Yep.
What you have here is just two kind of bananas movies, both that are sort of about haunted houses and are kind of funny in their own way. His more intentionally humorous, and that one, of course, absurdist in the same way that maybe something like As the Gods
For
Will
yeah.
is. Funny enough, As the Gods Will probably would have made it a really good double feature for houses.
Magical evil cats. You talked about like a bed that eats people. There's like some sort of just crazy scene at the end where they're like kind of surfing around on a piano in a lake of blood, I think. It's crazy.
Yes. Yeah.
I can see it on the marquee. I can see the crowd for that film. And so that's it for me. What did you pair with this one?
I went with what would be the most obvious pick, but I also see a crowd around the corner because there's great love for both Houseu, which is also known as House, and 1985's House by director Steve Meyer.
Yeah, I thought about it.
Both are ostensibly horror comedies. Both have a lot to say about war. With House, it's a lot more about Vietnam, and it brings a lot of pathos to its film that's much more direct, but it is also just batshit crazy and has a really wry sense of humor. Plus, you get this sort of culture clash of two movies that are called House, but have very different takes about sort of similar material. The House movie starring Stephen Catt, directed by Steve Miner, is more of a traditional Hollywood horror film. But it's a really goddamn good one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it is for me.
I love both of these. I don't know that I'm ready to make any decisions here. I really like both of these pairings.
I'm not there. They're both really, really good pairings. Mm-hmm. What did you decide to go with 1987's Dolls?
I felt like we talked so much about doll movies and already and that kind of thing that I decided to just be a lot more conventional. We're going to do a Stuart Gordon thing. People love coming out for director retrospectives. I wanted to pair Dolls with my favorite Stuart Gordon film, which is Castle Freak, starring... My favorite that isn't Reanimator, Castle Freak with the unbelievable Barbara Crampton.
I thought of the same thing.
Yeah.
And I didn't go with it because my brain tripped and went in a totally different direction. Does the name Kim Cattrall mean anything to you, Merrigan?
It does.
Yeah, man. Both 1987 films, Dolls and Mannequin. For me, is just an absolute chef's kiss pairing, man.
All right.
Objects come to life. They exist to judge, reward, or punish humans.
Yeah.
No one asks enough questions about how deeply unsettling any of this is. Man alive. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Like, these two belong in a double bill together. It just the hilarity alone of seeing Dolls and Mannequin.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be so great. Andrew McCarthy actually made it into one of my dueling double bills, which is saying something.
It is.
No, but for real, I have to say, I actually have a soft spot in my heart for Mannequin. It's pure pop goof cinema.
Mm-hmm.
She looks terrific. He's actually funny. Something happened to him. Something terrible happened to him. I guess it was that Rolling Stone article that said he was part of a Brat Pack and he just lost himself. But man, he was still on, I feel, in 87 when he made Mannequin. And Dolls in and of itself has a kind of wry, funny sensibility in a different direction.
Mm.
They're very similar plot-wise. They just go in two different directions.
Yep. I love it. I love it. This is my gut reaction right off the bat.
Okay, your gut reaction. Look at go them, with it.
I like both of our pairings with House almost equally. I think I'm willing
solid.
To call that a wash, but I want to give you Dolls and Mannequin. That's how I'm feeling right now. That's how I'm feeling.
It was originally.
I like it. Well, I like the pairing. I think you make a great argument for it. And I was not particularly enthused about just kind of a straight up Stuart Gordon retrospective.
I'm going to agree with you. I like it better than Castle Freak. I also agree that our two picks with Houseu being House and Evil Dead 2. How could you choose? Maybe we'd make that a three-way.
Wouldn't that be something?
Like, oh shit, that would be a, oh.
Yep.
If you have a film that you feel would pair better with Houseu or with Dolls, please let us know. You can write to me at jay@filmjitsu.net or you can leave a comment right on the website. You can hit us up on the socials. You'll find us. We're there. Nobody else is called Film Jitsu.
You could take me out to lunch and just tell me about it.
He would be cool with that.
Yeah. I am excited, Jay, to give you the next film that you are going to be watching for Film Jitsu. Our next episode comes out, if I'm not wrong, the weekend of Valentine's Day.
Oh, wow.
And so love is in the air, but... This is Film Jitsu, so it's a foul stench that only we can offer. And for your next episode, you're watching a real doozy. A movie so wrongheaded and fucked up that it begs the question, how did this ever get past the elevator pitch? From 1984, starring Michael Caine and Joseph Baloney, you're watching...
Ooh.
Yeah, Joseph Baloney. Uh-huh. I made sure I was pronouncing it right. And you're about to find out because you're going to be watching Blame It on Rio.
This is weird, man.
Uh-huh.
This is weird.
Uh-huh.
I recently was thinking about giving you this movie.
Okay, yes, because it is a movie that... Dumbfoundingly imagines itself as a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
But that Roger Ebert, in his one-star review, asks of his readers, as a general rule, I think it's wrong for a married man of 47 to have an affair with his best friend's 17-year-old daughter, don't you? Well, yeah, I fucking do. But this movie doesn't seem bothered by it in the slightest. It is a problem. And on our next episode, Blame It on Rio is your problem.
My God. I remember seeing it when I was a kid and thinking the chick was super hot. Mm. So,
well, because you were a kid.
And she was too.
Yeah, that would have been appropriate to be a child. It would not be appropriate to be 47-year-old Michael Caine. We're going to have to grapple with all of that. And here's the real shocker.
Okay.
The bottom five.
Oh, no. Don't be May December, please.
No. Here's the real shocker. This absolute trash of a film was directed by the Stanley Donen.
Oh, yeah.
One of the greatest directors of all time, and certainly a guy who dominated the 1950s. We're talking On the Town, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, mm-hmm. Funny Face, Damn Yankees. Oh, and Singing in the Rain, by the way, which for my money might just be one of the greatest American films ever made. That Stanley Donen,
damn.
Also in 1984, some fucking how made Blame It on Rio.
Oh, how the
and
mighty have
so,
fallen.
For our bottom five, we are going to do our, what I'm calling our bottom five black sheep.
Oh, I like it.
That one title in a filmography can be a director, can be a performer, I don't care, but that one movie where you're like, what the hell happened?
Love it.
I think it's going to be an interesting episode. I think it's going to be an upsetting episode. I think it's going to be a little bit of a minefield for us, and all of those things are things that I'm interested in. I hope that our listeners will be as well.
Wow.
And I hope that they will all come back and join us next time when you are going to review 1984's Blame It on Rio. But until then, we have been your hosts. I am Mike.
And I am Jay.
And we'll see you next time. Stalno mislim na te, hoću znat sve kate, vježbat ću sate i sate, karate, karate, vježbat ću dok zadnji mi kjaj, zastane i zađe. Santo, Santo, I love you, I enjoy you. I'm never irritated with you about anything. I love doing the show. I think it's funny that we sometimes have to scour the earth to find a movie, mostly because I'm a fucking Luddite more than anything. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, and so like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know.